Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC. Tennessee just sounds perfect. Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Hey, this is Annie, and welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You, a production of iHeartMedia and How Stuff Works. Hello again, listeners. I'm once again joined by Samantha.
Hi.
Said again twice, and now that's three times.
Oh, wow.
And this is our... In the last episode, you got to sit in on a therapy session, one of mine.
Right, yours.
And it was, for me, very vulnerable and frightening experience. And now right. It's your
and
turn,
now
Samantha.
It's my turn. And y'all, I laugh because when we decided we were going to do this, I was like, oh, yeah, we're definitely going to go in headstrong. And I'm so excited. And then I was like, oh, I have to do therapy. Like I kind of paused as I was realizing, oh yeah, that means I have to unearth all the things that I try to stuff down as much as possible because coping, right?
Right.
Just so I'm going to do the trigger warnings since I guess you don't know what happened, Andy, right?
Nope, not yet.
Again, like we said in the last one, we did not sit in with each other
on these
episodes.
We're friends, but we're not those guys.
We're so close. But I've been talking. I said, let's go ahead and do therapy sessions together as a couple.
Yeah.
Isn't this what happens? We're a couple now?
Work wives? Yeah.
How that goes?
Exactly.
So for trigger warning, it is going to have a lot of childhood trauma, neglect, emotional, and physical abuse. I don't think I do too much about sexual abuse, but just to know, if you have abandonment issues or if you have attachment issues, it may trigger you.
Mm-hmm.
So just to throw that out there. Before we started, I know Annie had we talked about some types of therapy and how to find a good therapist. And I'm going to put this as a backstory. I have a long history with therapy. And several therapists and several rounds of healing tactics from religious to clinical. I've experienced several different forms. Studying social work and being in the treatment field, sometimes it gets really easy to play the diagnosis game.
Mm-hmm.
I, like many of my generation, grew up with the thought that therapy was a sign of weakness and prayer should be enough. Now, please know, I'm not saying anything about religion or prayer, but as someone who has been in the field for a while, I know there are things that need to be dealt with on a clinical level.
Yeah.
And maybe even on a psychiatric level.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say psychiatric, in the state of Georgia, psychiatry is a lot of like medication, specifically types of anxiety, depression, ADHD, all of those types of things. And I'm not one of those proponents who advocate for pills, but I think it can be necessary.
Right.
And again, like I said, people of faith are amazing people. They can be, and that might be enough.
Yeah.
But, again, there are things that cannot be addressed just by hope.
Yes.
This is those moments of when you need community, when you need outside help, and that's okay. And again, like I said before, I did go that religious avenue, and for that moment, it was okay. But eventually, I had to go a little beyond. And now that we're talking about the little beyond or the clinical level, mm-hmm. I want to talk about specific types of therapy. In the previous episode, Annie, I know we discussed different types of therapy, but I wanted to get a little more in-depth in the definitions of some of these types of therapy. And just to throw this out there, there's like over 50
there's a lot.
To 100 probably, and it's always developing, and there's always new ideas, there's new concepts, and also there's also new some diagnoses that haven't been diagnosed yet. So we know that the DSM-5, DSM-4, it keeps coming out because it has to reevaluate what is out there. So for a long while, autism and being on the spectrum was called Asperger's. And Asperger's was an overall term that was like a general umbrella for people who may not be severe Asperger's, mm-hmm. But they realize this is a spectrum and you may have the lesser to the larger. And it became a new diagnosis in itself, and Asperger's was kind of thrown out the window. And I think that's necessary for many of things. We've changed the idea of multiple personality disorder has also become something else, which is dissociative identity disorder.
Right.
So I think, you know, it changes constantly, and the therapy types and the therapy therapeutic theories have changed, mm-hmm. and will continue to change because one of the things that we don't understand quite completely is the brain,
it's the mind. It's complicated as it turns
out.
Right,
it's the chemicals, it's all of that. Mm-hmm. But we did want to talk about a little bit of what is out there, what is there, and I'm only giving a few of those. One of them would be CBT. We talked about that previously, the cognitive behavioral therapy. And the concept behind that is that our thoughts about a situation, how we feel and how we behave are all interrelated. This teaches you to change and examine how you think, act in order for you to change how you feel. And again, I think that's important because how we feel sometimes takes over what we should think or the logical senses, right?
Oh, yes.
That's enough for me. And this is often actually used for children as young as 4 and focuses more on behavior. So I work with children, and this is one of the things is if they have erratic behaviors or hyperactive behaviors, maybe CBT could be an alternate route to medication. Mm-hmm. And some of the diagnoses that may be treated with CBT include substance abuse, anxiety, depression, PTSD, and self-esteem issues, and so many things. Because under CBT, we have things like DBT, which you had also talked about, the dialectical behavior therapy. And this is, again, a type of CBT and usually teaches skills such as how to manage attention or mindfulness skills, manage and cope with emotions or emotional regulation skills, deal effectively with others, the interpersonal skills, and tolerate emotion distress, so distress tolerance skills. This is a bit more intensive and also actually involves groups. Uh-huh. And it is often used for borderline personality disorder. I know that was an episode with stuff Mom never told you previously, eating disorders, self-harming behaviors, and even anger issues. Mm-hmm. And then we also want to talk about EMDR. Actually, I think that was highlighted on Russian Doll.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, the whole light thing. I don't know if any of you have seen that. I hope that's not a spoiler.
Light thing.
Spoiler. because one of the caretakers to the main character is a therapist. Uh-huh. And she has this light thing where she uses. But this is a non-traditional form of psychotherapy designed to diminish negative feelings associated with memories or traumatic events. So the goal of EMDR is to fully process past experiences and sort out the emotions attached to these experiences. And then I also want to talk about the trauma-focused cognitive therapy, which is a form of cognitive behavior therapy. Uh-huh. And that addresses the specific emotion and mental health needs of children, adolescents, adult survivors, and families who are struggling to overcome the destructive effects of early trauma. So narrative therapy, which is a form of counseling that views people as separate from their problems. This allows people to get distance from the issues to see how it might actually be helping them mm-hmm. or processing them more than if it's hurting them. So essentially, you write it out as if you're the third person, from what I understand. And again, I don't know. I think as you told me, that's what you may be doing, a narrative.
So part of my therapy is narrative work, which is basically describing something, a traumatic experience in my case. And going through it step by step. And then if you get overwhelmed and you feel like you can't tell the story, then you have to, there's these things called like the stress units, and you have to what is, identify why, what is it, why, how to manage it, and then try to tell the whole story.
Right.
And I've done it one time with one of my experiences so far, and it was difficult, but
right.
I can see the value in it for right. sure.
So that's kind of the route I'll be going, future therapies, just because it was so, it's so traumatic for me to go back.
Yeah.
And honestly, because the memories are so fuzzy, mm-hmm. that it's best to be a third person story. And again, these are just a small list, obviously, of all the types of therapy that is out there. I found one about feminist therapy.
Yeah.
You and I had talked about that, which was fascinating in itself. It started in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, it's all about empowerment and growing. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm down for that. I'm
yeah.
down for that. Give me that. And like I said, it is according to you. And we told you in the previous episodes about trying to find a good therapist, you need to see what they're qualified in. They typically have a list of their specialties,
mm-hmm.
and that is good to look at.
Yes, for sure. And another thing from our past episode is our disclaimer, which we can kind of briefly do. If you want a more detailed disclaimer, listen to the one before this.
Right.
But legally, we went through all the hoops of having these on air.
Right, essentially signing all the disclosure forms.
Consent forms.
HIPAA forms.
Yes. And this has been months of talking about, of doing therapy and then talking about what would be healthy and what wouldn't for us to share in this kind of format. So we've done all those things. We are protecting each other. There's
right.
been confidentiality. And we are podcasters. We sign the forms. If you get therapy, I promise you, unless you sign a form and have a podcast, like,
yeah.
it's confidential.
And again, it was so unusual. Dr. Coleman was like, well, let me think about this. How
yes.
do we make this legal
yes.
and protective of both you and I?
Yes. So we're about to get to the session here, but first we're going to pause for a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snagajob. Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring.
With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time, or full-time.
You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that.
With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way.
Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
Visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242-424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise, all things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Hey, so yes, we're about to get into my session. And I'm going to tell you, it's going to be a little more intense than, I'm already feeling it, than Annie, because somehow, my sessions in the last two sessions, again, we told you we were doing previously, was not this intense, but we did discuss that what I needed at this point in time in my sessions were to break down my past, because a lot of my triggering, a lot of my episodes happen with what she would call body memory. Mm-hmm. And for me, I would say sensory triggering. Mm-hmm. Because it's not necessarily things that I completely clearly remember. It's what I experience. So it may be a smell. It may be a taste. It may be a conversation. But typically it's smell and taste mm-hmm. is what I do more. Or even like the fear in itself may be familiar to me. So I'm right. medically like the fight or flight. So we're going to be discussing what you're going to hear are my times in the orphanage and with my biological family. I am adopted. I was adopted when I was 7. And I came into the U.S. from South Korea. Beforehand, I was actually in an orphanage. And beforehand, I was actually in the care of a biological grandmother who was very strict. And from the memories that I have, was physically abusive. And you're going to hear a lot of themes of that. And you're going to hear moments of me kind of having breakdowns, but revelations, I guess, about the past memories. So just to throw that out there, you're going to hear me cry. But you know what? I'm okay with that because crying is not weakness. So nope. Here you go. Thank you for doing this. And
my
real talk. I'm nervous.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about that.
All right. Here we go. I guess in general, obviously, I've talked a lot about my trauma. For a while now, like that's been a part of my job, that's been a part of my passion. Mm-hmm. But going in depth, which is what you and I were talking about in general, is really nerve-wracking for me because unrooting things that I mm-hmm. can't quite remember is very fearful. I guess I'm anticipating, because I am a pessimist. Maybe a realist, however you want to look at it, that the worst case uh-huh. scenario may happen.
Depending on the day.
Right. And, you know, you and I talked about the parental situation with the feminist talk, and that went even worse than I thought. So I'm not going to lie, it's kind of where I'm at in life, expecting the worst case scenario.
But
I'm a little nervous. Because, again, I kind of forgot I had to be a part of this.
Right. And you certainly don't have to be. But
no.
I understand and appreciate the reason yeah. why you are putting yourself out there and right. being vulnerable. And I know that that's going to send a really powerful message to people that hear it. So feeling like things, like kind of things have happened in terms of some events in your life so far is like worst case scenario, meaning recent conversations with family. Are you part of, is the fear also related to like who's going to hear this?
Of course.
How it will impact them.
I think in general, whether it is just talking about the past, including being in Korea in an orphanage, even though that has nothing to do with current situations or my current family members, I still am afraid that they're going to see that as an attack or me being ungrateful, which you and I have talked about already, mm-hmm. that I have this double guilt
yeah.
of really wishing I had a whole case, different case scenario in some aspects, mm-hmm. as well as the fact that I feel ungrateful. And I've been mm-hmm. privileged, obviously, mm-hmm. because I'm in this position where I am mm-hmm. healthy, I am mm-hmm. able to be educated, I am able to cope and fend for myself and survive. But at the same time, there's so many things I feel like is lacking and missing in my life and mm-hmm. has been part of the reason that I can't connect with people. Again, you and I mm-hmm. have talked about that.
Yeah.
And I feel like the only way I'm going to say this is a kind of a thought process mm-hmm. is that the only way that I've been able to connect with people is if I feel like I can serve them in somehow, shape, or manner or support mm-hmm. them. And that's my worth. Like, I have to prove my worth, essentially.
Yeah.
And you and I talked about the whole rejection factor and the fact that I fear that. With the rejection, that I'm also in the way and an inconvenience. I think you and I talked about mm-hmm. that as well.
Yeah, we've talked about a lot of that. It's all connected,
it
right?
Is. Like, right.
You know, the idea of some of the survivor guilt that I'm hearing, right, about you are a child that was adopted. Mm-hmm. And what about the children that you knew that may not have been?
Right.
So right. There's that element. But then also some of the culture within the home that you were adopted into.
Right.
Also perpetuates,
right.
Like you mentioned, some of this feelings of if you have an adverse reaction or if you have an opinion that differs from those of your other family members, that then you're ungrateful.
Right.
And what a burden that's been right. for you.
Right. And yeah, I guess I know the last time we talked about the fact that I do want to dig deeper because that's mm-hmm. the aspect that I feel like has been obviously the cornerstone of my reactions and my relationships mm-hmm. and my triggering and my mm-hmm. whole traumatic background, as well as like even my current field and my passions, mm-hmm. To be mm-hmm. very, very candid. But I think, I'm not going to lie, I'm really scared. Like, it's mm-hmm. not anything of the, like, I'm not going to mince words. I'm scared.
Right. Of course. I mean, it's kind of uncharted territory and it's not comfortable.
Right.
It's going to be something new that you'll dive into, you know? And I think we've discussed about how you're at a place in your life where it's becoming apparent that it's necessary.
Right.
Because ways that you have been able to cope may not be working as well for you.
Right.
As they were in the past.
Exactly.
So I'll say the spiel that you know, and I'm sure you also say to the people you work with, you get to control the pace of this,
right?
You get to decide what we talk about regarding some of the trauma reprocessing and going back to peeling back the layers of a lot of experiences that you probably have not thought about as much.
Right.
And so if there's ever a time when we're talking about something or we get onto a topic and you're feeling really triggered or emotionally reactive and just feeling like you need a pause or you want to change topics, you get to control that.
Okay.
So you just let me know and I'll continue to check in with you.
Okay.
So in terms of places to start, I know that we've chatted a bit about some of the memories, there being pieces of memories.
Mm-hmm.
And some memories being concrete and then a lot of the memories really being held also in your body versus verbal.
Right.
I'm wondering, in light of those conversations, if there's a place that feels safest for us to start to talk.
I don't know if it's the safest. Maybe it's the most clear, mm-hmm. in which, of course, I would rather know than not. That's kind of my whole thing. I would rather know if something's bad. And I feel okay with that, so I can at least be prepared, or I've already reacted. So some of the things that I do remember is the fact that I lived with my biological grandmother, who's the mother of my biological mother, who gave me up at a very young age. And I was told later that it was due to the fact that she got remarried. And within the South Korean culture, I don't know if it's law or whether it's just cultural, that typically a half-child or a stepchild does not live with a male to prevent a further abuse and or stigma. I don't actually know.
Mm.
And so in which I was given to the care of my grandmother, who was a very strict woman. Mm. I was the only child with her who owned, I think, a restaurant. It was some kind of serving thing. I know that for sure.
Oh, it's interesting. You see how that theme has popped up already. Okay. We'll bookmark that one.
I know that I could not stay with my biological father because of his alcoholism. Now, that was something that I remember clearly because mm-hmm. I rarely saw him, but I might have visited with his mother. And I do have some memories of going with her at mm-hmm. one point in time.
Let me pause you for a second and ask so that to see if there's elements of this conversation that we can kind of even dial into in more personal ways. Do you remember any of their names?
I do not. Wow, I've never been asked that. And I'm very quick to react because, as you said, that there's nothing triggering. The only reason I know my Korean name is because it's on my birth certificate from Korea.
What is your Korean name?
My Korean name is Lee So Young. So my family name would have been Lee. And the only reason I do know that is because, again, part of my birth certificate, but my adoptive parents actually put that in my American name. So my full name is Samantha Lee McVeigh. So they kept my, they did do that. They kept my, I will say for what they could do, they tried to keep my heritage. But that was my family name. And outside of that, I honestly don't know. Because I can't even remember anybody calling me by my name. Oddly enough.
How does it feel for you to say your Korean name out loud?
It feels foreign, I guess, the best way to say it. It doesn't feel real. I can't identify with that.
Yeah.
And maybe part of that has to do with even in being in Korea when I was in the orphanage, I wanted to be someone else, and I pretended to be someone else, whether it was trying to protect myself from the hurt that was happening within my own age group, within the kids that were there or the girls that were in there, or whether it's because I felt disowned. Maybe that was the best word I have. But yeah, I can't even think that through. So to me, it's such a distant idea that I can't identify with that. And if someone were to ever call me that, I would never turn around. It would not be a thing that would turn around. I did remember I would write it out as a kid in Korean. And then I remembered it as an adult trying to write it out when I was taking the Korean classes in college. But yeah, I actually don't identify with that at all.
Right. So when you say it, there is not an emotional connection or reaction?
No.
Okay.
It's an unfamiliar territory, almost as if I'm telling a story. Or almost like I feel like I'm reaching to find my identity, but it's not me.
Mm-hmm. Like you're describing somebody else.
Right. It really does.
Which is interesting because that was the picture that I was getting when I was hearing you start to talk about it. Like, obviously setting the scene, which is any part of sharing a narrative, the absence of like that emotional connection.
Yeah.
Which we'll get into because I think that there's something to be said about that too.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's just the loss of feeling that emotional connection and what that has meant for you.
I'm not going to lie, just realizing, saying that to you, and then you asking me the question about their names, it's definitely putting a lot of, not necessarily darkness, but overwhelming guilt, because that's what I live off of, because I feel like I should. And for some reason, it feels like I'm failing. I don't know. I think because I remember when I was a kid here in the U.S. that one day I just started crying. And my adoptive mother asked me why. And I said, because I can't remember her name. And I was talking about the biological grandmother who took care of me. And I couldn't remember her face. I remember saying that. And my mother was, my adoptive mother was very compassionate about that and just talked, continued to tell me how they did the best they could, and they did what was best for me in putting me in the orphanage for adoption. But, yeah, I remember, I don't even know how old I was. I think 10 or 11. And just feeling distraught that I could not remember what she looked like. And I could not remember her name.
I don't see that's still is emotionally impactful.
It is.
You see that emotion in your face.
I haven't thought about that memory in a long time, actually, obviously. As I'm trying to remember, because as we're talking about this, because obviously that's all related.
Yeah.
Because even though the memories of my biological family are not the greatest, because all of that has something to do with either guilt or survival, it still feels like I have let someone down, weirdly enough. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to be more specific, do you feel like you've let your Korean family down and that they had expectations for you to remember them?
No. I don't know if that's the thing as much as that was my life at one point in time. Mm-hmm. But more so for me, I think it was just forgetting part of my life. And it's this whole guilt of like, I need to remember everything. I need to remember the good things. I need to know that I need to be grateful that I'm not dead. I need to remember that I need to be grateful mm-hmm. that I did have another opportunity instead of being one more statistic mm-hmm. of all the darkness that can happen for many of the girls mm-hmm. that are cast aside and mm-hmm. in that area or in that time frame. But yeah, I think it's just, and as a kid, I think I needed to know, I needed to feel like they missed me. And if that was the case, that I needed to remember who they were.
Yeah.
So that could be.
By somebody missing you means that they valued you.
Right. That
you were important to them.
That someone cared.
Yep.
Outside of that. So I think whether it's a wishful thinking and or whether it's just me feeling needing to feel guilty because I'm okay. Whichever one that is.
Mm-hmm. What I'm struck by is your level of insight at such a young age, because I understand as an adult and you know, where you are now in your life, looking back at that time frame of adoptions from Korea. Like, I know that you are aware of all of the sociopolitical mm-hmm. culture and implications around that. But when you were in it as a young child, it seems like you had this awareness of needing to be present, or you describe it as to be grateful for everything because things could have been worse. And I'm curious about what you remember about where you picked up those messages.
I don't honestly know whether it was more of like the daily survival in the orphanage, because I just remember everything that was happening, me leaving, me being adopted, me being in a different country, me having a new family. And it could have been just ingrained in me because it was almost the motto, good things are happening because you're leaving here. You're getting a new opportunity. You're getting a new family. They want you. And it could be very well the case that was the first time I've been told I've been wanted, and that I was chosen. And I know even with my now the adoptive family, their story on adopting me was a long process. So it was it felt like for them it was faith and God doing the perfect timing. And obviously I'm not as religious, but in my mind it was like it is. Cool. Mm-hmm. It's not coincidental, but it seemed like if there's fate, it's fate. And so therefore I should be grateful for that. And that, because that's my origin story, essentially, instead of just talking about the birth story. It began in the 1970s before I was born with my adoptive parent having a movement and wanting to adopt and then fostering instead and having to wait until I was actually in the orphanage for a year or two to be adopted. And she, my mother, had a specific country and a specific gender, and she wanted, she didn't necessarily need a baby, which is rare, as you know. And so all of those things seemed to just align perfectly. And I think just with that and with the religious aspect, it's gratefulness or miracles. Those, both of those things come into play. So I don't know if it's though necessarily like it came after or began before that I was told and thought and needed to believe that, yes, I'm supposed to, I'm the one. for all.
Yeah, that needing to believe that about, and just thinking about how adaptive that was.
Yeah, and
for you,
and I think, and that's probably again why I am a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
There's no in my thought process in beginning this career, beginning this avenue is there's no way I went through all of this for just for me. Or there's no way that I can and feel and know this or learn or grow into this empathy without a purpose. And again, this is also where I watch children, and if they're not in the same place or if they're not able to get to that same place as I am or be able to react the way I am, I feel guilty because I could. Or even though being in where I am, being where I'm at, it feels very privileged for me to be at this point. And therefore, with that privilege, I should do more.
Yeah, I want to pause on that for a second because there's a couple things I want to point out. One, that it's not a either or, but it's a both and, right? Like there's room for both truths to exist, that there may have been things that you wish had been done differently, but also you can still hold the gratitude, mm-hmm. right? That is there space in your mind and your heart for both of those feelings to be there? And then also keeping in mind language like should, because that oftentimes can set all of us up for negative feelings, but also believing thoughts that are not helpful to mm-hmm. us. Like there is, you know, words like should, never, could, always. We don't live, life isn't absolute like that.
Right.
So I think that you've done really wonderful things and have used your story and your experiences to continue to help support other people. You know, making sure to honor that within yourself too. And lightening up on some of those more oppressive thoughts that you may say within your own self-talk.
I think that's really hard for me to do.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I know that you had started kind of talking a bit about what you do remember, and you were sharing about your maternal grandmother
mm-hmm.
and how you understand how you came to live with her,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that you had some visits with your paternal grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a bit more about what you did with your maternal grandmother.
I think you and I had already kind of discussed some of the things that I do remember, which were not the greatest memories.
Mm-hmm.
of a woman who's very, very strict. I honestly don't remember much. I told you about watching mm-hmm. Michael Jackson and Madonna and mm-hmm. me knowing that as the U.S. at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
that just dated me, didn't it? but then I think I told you about the fact that I never actually had toys.
Yeah.
And that one of the reasons I think I went to see the paternal side, they did mm-hmm. try to send me, from what I remember, gifts and toys, and it was never given to me. I was shown it, but was told that I had to earn it, and I can't remember ever earning one. Mm-hmm. And these are where I have the dreams that kind of intertwine, because the memories I do have. So I have this weird memory of watching them making kimchi in a giant tub.
Mm.
I remember that. And then also having a memory of men coming in, and nothing bad, at my grandmother's, the biological maternal grandmother's, who mm. were customers, who were regulars and knew her. Mm. And then them being kind to me, I do remember that. But me being told I need to be in the back room, which is, so if what I remember is a store or a restaurant with a back room where we lived or back area where we lived. Mm-hmm. had a remember a really weird, and I now realize I believe it had to be a dream because there's no way it could have been true, that I'd cut off a finger essentially, except for a little piece of like of skin on, and I could just see the blood and pulp and all of that when I was trying to eat an apple. And my grandmother coming back there because I'm screaming and telling me to be quiet because I'm disturbing the customers. And one of the customers came back and helped me wrap it up and telling me I need to be quiet and everything will be okay. But that's all of the memory that I have of that. And I swore up and down, I think when I was younger, that there was a scar on my hand, on my finger where it happened. But looking back, I'm like, that's... that can't be right.
You don't have a scar on your hand?
I don't think I do have a scar on my hand. Neither would I have had a finger since I wasn't taken to the hospital to be reattached. Right. So the senses came way later, but it was so distinctive. It was so real. And I had it. I was a kid when I was swearing up and down this happened to me. So, but I still remember it very clearly. Like, as I'm talking to you about it, I remember the feeling of being yelled at because I was, once again, getting in the way or being too loud. And I was in dire need, and I didn't get it, and I had to learn to be quiet.
Right, so maybe that's the message of that dream or that experience, right? Like, maybe it's not the literal finger being cut off, although you could have witnessed somebody else's finger and it could have been traumatic to you. And, you know, as children, children, they see something bad happen to somebody else and their first thought is themselves.
Right.
What if that happens to me? That could possibly happen to me, kind of a thing.
Right.
So there's a lot of possible explanations, but overall, this idea of you being in dire need and that need not being met or not being met by a caregiver, but by a stranger.
Right.
Who came and then wrapped up your finger.
Yeah, I definitely, honestly, I think that, like I said, the kimchi memory is what I have. A memory of me eating with chopsticks and a fork is what I have. And then I have another memory of which I'm pretty sure partially, I can't tell, that I had been locked out of a home. By the home because I came in too late, so I had to stay outside the remainder of the night. And that would put me up before 5, 6. But then I have another memory in which I did that, and then I get attacked by a dog. And I start screaming in the same scenario of my grandmother coming out telling me to be quiet because I was waking people up. And that is not that bad. So... But I feel, I don't know, the two separate feels like it blended. Like there was an incident that did happen that I blended with a nightmare that could have made it worse. But again, that's kind of the memory that I have. And then I have another one in which I went to the paternal grandmother's and they were going to make something with an egg, which I dropped it. And the severe disappointment and the amount of disapproval that I got for dropping the egg as a 4 or 5 year old was so harsh that I remember feeling like I had done the worst thing ever. And that I did not, I think ended up being without food that day or that night because of the incident. So I do remember that. And then the other memories that I do have are have a memory of going with my dad to his work. I'm not sure if this is real, but it seemed kind of real because one, I think he was a musician. Two, I think it was at a bar or a strip club because I remember being doted on by several young women at that place. And I don't know where that fits in. There was nothing really bad about it because people were paying attention to me. And that was the last thing I remember of that. And I do remember being told by both the paternal and the maternal grandmother that my dad was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And that's why he was rarely there. But mm-hmm. he was never cruel. He was mm-hmm. the reason I was getting these presents that I wasn't able to have, because he was trying to give it to me, get it to me. Those mm-hmm. are the memories I have of that.
When you were a child at that time, did you know what alcoholic?
No.
Like, did you know what they meant or what that?
No.
Did you have any idea?
Okay. No. I think the reason I remember part of that was I have this distinct memory of a smell. And I didn't realize it until I was older. It's this weird, like, the alcohol smell of beer where it sits. Yep. And I didn't know what that was. As a kid, my adoptive parents do not drink. It has never mm-hmm. been present around me when I was growing up. So I never knew what that was. But when someone mm-hmm. would drink and I was around, it was so familiar that I couldn't figure out why.
Interesting.
And even now, if I smell it now, there are moments, and it's specifically beer, that I remember that really distinct alcohol smell, like someone who drank beer or a large amount of beer that's on their mouth. I remember that smell. The other day, actually, I was sleeping, and there was a half-open bottle of beer, or not bottle, but a can of beer, but that throughout the night, I smelled it. I was like, what is that? And it was so familiar. And that kind of linked back to, oh, yeah, this is me growing up as a kid. I remember the smell and couldn't figure out what it was. But I remember feeling sad. I guess that's the best word. Because it wasn't necessarily sad, because it didn't have sad memories for me, because there was nothing volatile about those mm-hmm. moments when I smelled that. But I just know it was familiar, and I wasn't supposed to be around that or something along those lines.
Yeah.
So
it had a really deep ingrained association for you.
Yeah, that smell is very familiar. And I now recognize it a little more, of course, as an adult, that smell, than when I was a kid trying to figure out what that was.
Mm-hmm. That's also a really great example of how our bodies hold memories.
Yeah.
Even before, or even without, like, a verbal memory of something, right? Because as a small child, not knowing how the adults explained alcoholism to you, or if they did it at all, I don't know what that meant. But that smell continues to bring you back to that moment all these years later is significant, but also really gets at how important it is at a healing, because the trauma can continue to recreate itself and be re-triggered throughout different stages of life. There was a connection I wanted to make when you were talking about the egg incident and the significant disappointment that you sensed from the adults in that experience. Again, just like these early childhood experiences and how they impact you as an adult and have helped shape who you are. The idea of not wanting to disappoint. Mm-hmm. That's been a recurring thing that I've heard you talk about throughout the session.
Mm-hmm. I think
it seems like it may have started back then.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I know you and I talked about the incident where my adoptive sister gave me a look, and that sent me into a turmoil where I just cried for an entire hour or so. Yeah, and then even, like, I remember I have very strong opinionated friends, which I love. I'm trying to be like them. But essentially, if I feel like I'm in the way, or I might be rejected, or I might do something wrong, I try to avoid it altogether. And that includes part of my introvertedness is because of that. If I'm not explicitly invited and or going with someone who is invited as like a friend date type of thing, I don't want to go. If it's a friend group and they purposely left me out, it feels like a rejection. It feels like I'm in the way. And I have a hard time with that. I am more likely to read into things as being me being in the way or me not being wanted. Mm-hmm. As that being more likely than anything else. So if I feel like there's an in-between, or I felt like if it was an in-between thing, or like, yeah, whatever, I'm not going to show up. I'm not going to be there. Or I feel like I'm being purposely excluded, and it's fairly my fault. So I think that's been a recurring theme. Obviously, when I was doing the religious types of counseling, we talked about the fear of rejection, in which Jesus is great for that. He doesn't reject people. So that was nice.
That was the answer.
That was nice. Obviously, for me, I've started to let go of that a little more. And I think that's just being empowered enough to feel like, okay, even if I'm okay. I've survived. But disappointing people or failing has become the second language to rejection. So now I've gone past rejection. I've gone past being in the way of trying. Mm-hmm. And now if I try and I don't do well, or I'm not perceived as well, or if I'm not perceived as a big success, like there's not, even with this podcast that you and I talked about, you know, I told you I feel like I'm a giant imposter because I don't know. I'm so insecure and I'm trying to talk to other people about not being insecure. Even now, I'm like, if this doesn't do well, it's my fault and I failed. Which is the same level of my career as a social work. I talked about that. It's like I don't feel like I've made a difference. And though I can't see all the things and I know all the pep talk to it, you're making a difference, blah, 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 you don't see everything that's changed, it still feels like a failure at some point in time. And I feel like it's my fault. Mm-hmm. And or I haven't done enough, which is going back to the whole guilt thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly important. And I'm glad to hear that you're aware of how that's a core belief and how and what that's connected to, like really where the roots of that began. I think that that's something that you and I will likely need to process some more.
Right.
Because it doesn't seem helpful to you.
It's not.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't want to put my own assumptions on that, but I think it's safe to say.
Safe to say. It's not the most healthy way to go.
Everything is your fault. Yeah. Everything is your fault. Is not generally helpful.
Right.
Healthy for anyone.
Oddly enough, I don't know why.
Right. Because we can't control most things.
Right.
Particularly when it involves other people.
Right. Which is honestly one of the first things I tell the kids that I work with. You can't control anyone else but your own reactions. Mm-hmm. But yet, it's really hard to let go.
Oh, of course.
Especially when you
invest. Of course, because that belief has been reinforced by so many people throughout your life.
Right.
And experiences, not just people, all experiences.
Yeah.
We have some more for you listeners, but first we're going to pause for one more quick break for a word from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Snagajob. Snagajob is where America goes to hire with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring.
With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time, or full-time.
You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that.
With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way.
Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
Visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242-424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands.
not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
And just going back, I honestly, the things that I think I'm telling you are pretty much what I remember. And I don't know if it's because I have done so well in trying to push it down. Mm-hmm. And now I get triggered by the body memories or the senses that I have that I can't control as easily. And you and I talked about the conferences that I go to about the exploited children and having the moments of panic because it's too familiar. Some of the incidents are so familiar that I can't process it and deal with it at that point because I'm so confused about why I would feel that way. Because I can't clearly remember why.
Well, what do you remember about the transition from your maternal grandmother's care to the orphanage?
I kind of distinctly remember being picked up from my grandmother's and transported to the actual orphanage, in which my grandmother telling me I'm going on a trip. I was never told that I was actually leaving. What I was told was I would be going on a plane for a trip. I remember that because I got really excited about an airplane ride because that was such a foreign idea, and it was such a like fantasy almost to be on a plane. And so I remember being told that. I also remember going with this really kind woman who was like, I'm going to take you and get you a hamburger, which I'd never had before. Which, by the way, that's how you say it, with the more accents in it in Korean. Just in case you didn't know, because I remember that.
I didn't know that. Thank you. That's how I remember that.
I don't know how I remember that. And then also getting a banana for the first time, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. Those are the two, much like my life, food motivates me.
Yeah.
And that's what was like, yay, I'm going to get a hamburger and I'm going to get a banana. So I remember getting those things and showing up for the orphanage, and then that's it. So maybe it was the highlight of that. I do, and I think this is a part of the guilt where I was upset that I couldn't remember my grandmother. I do remember her crying. I do remember that. And there, that told me as a child that she cared. And I felt guilty for not remembering her. Now that I'm thinking back on that, that she was crying.
Because she knew what you leaving signified.
Right.
And although it was never communicated to you.
Exactly. And I don't think I don't know when I figured out I wasn't going home or going back. I don't think I was ever told. I think I just ended up being there so long that I figured it out.
Wow.
And that's when everything kicked in to start lying.
Yeah.
To survive with the girls who were, who had been there a lot longer than I had. And they were also trying to survive. And a lot of that means losing or being tough. And being tough means dominating. And being dominating meant making sure whoever came in knew who was the boss, essentially. I think part of the trauma that I had growing up was being bullied in an atmosphere that was all about surviving, essentially. So, yeah, I honestly can't tell you when I realized that I was never going back.
That I see the tears, you know,
yep,
of because I'm sure you're aware of what, when you realized that, what that may, what that must have been like for you as a child.
Right. Because I actually never thought of that either. But I can tell you, I do remember being told when I was leaving. So I have several, you and I talked about several of the incidents in between the fact. But I do remember being told I was being adopted. And part of that had to do with, I think the only friend I made at that point had left before me to go to France, if I remember correctly. And so soon after, I was being told that I would be leaving too, because my one and only friend had left. And I actually, unfortunately, I had pictures of her, actually. We had pictures taken together. Because there was a group of missionaries that came in. I think they were American missionaries, if I remember correctly. And of course, that was very documented, which is kind of ironic and funny to me because I became one of those missionaries in college that went and visited others and other like cottage, like homes and such. But I remember being told, being taken into a small room, and I told you about the two women who were very much advocates for me, telling me that I was leaving, and them handing me a booklet of the family that I was going to live with. Or I was going home with. And I remember sitting there looking, going through those pictures and being excited, also being confused because they were really white. And so I hadn't been around white people until that point. Actually, at all. Okay, guys, so thank you. Obviously, you heard it kind of abruptly end because we did have some issues with the internet. However, I felt it was still a good ending because it's a process.
Yeah.
So obviously, it was one therapy session, and we are only starting.
But yeah.
I am only starting. And I will tell you, out of the 5 years of therapy that I've gone through, I'll say five. I'm estimating how many times I've been in therapy. This is the first time I've been able to concentrate on my past. Previously, I had so much trauma on a daily basis, whether it's death of kids, whether it's triggered because of some type of training, all of those things. Because social work is a difficult field. To my social workers out there, I'm here for you. I got you.
Yeah.
But it has finally come to the point that I can actually face those and address these moments. And it's been 30-something years.
Yeah,
that I had to even think about it. And I actually, Annie, you texted me, asked me how it went. I was like, oh, it was rough.
Yeah. True story.
And that's the thing, is it was rough. And I'm going to tell you, these are the moments that it's going to be hard for me. I'm not going to come out feeling like I'm healed. I'm not going to come out like everything's okay. I'm going to come out really raw and really vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I went home to my friend. I was like, I need a hug. I need a hug. Which is, you don't know me, but I'm not a touchy-feely person.
Yeah.
That is not my persona. And being independent and being strong, being sarcastic, cynical, that's my thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So having these moments of like, I cried on air or on the mic. Holy crap. Or I had to go home and tell someone, I need you to be with me right now because this was really overwhelming.
Yeah.
And it's okay. Yeah. For me, it was a big breakthrough to be able to talk about some of the things that I didn't think on and some of the things I didn't think on but actually affect my relationships today, affect how I process things, or even affect my relationship with my family, affect the way I perceive people and some of the reasons I may have a successful relationship or an unsuccessful relationship. So, even though it is as intense as it sounded, and it's probably going to be very, it's unfulfilling because you're not going to hear the end of this, but we will come back and tell you how it goes. It's okay. And I went through a moment, had a moment to digest, and I had to be able to say, this is where I need to be. Mm-hmm. And vulnerability is okay. Also, you all may have heard me stumble through trying to get out of my chair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The damn headphones. I just want you to know, trapped me. And I was by myself. And I was like, I'm going to live here now. And so I was fighting very hard with these damn headphones.
It sounds like an epic struggle.
Look, it felt like it took 2 hours. I know it was probably like 5 minutes, but I was like, what the hell is this?
I mean, 5 minutes to struggle with.
Again, that may be also an exaggeration, but these headphones were trying to kill me. I want you to
know
that.
That's the only logical explanation.
This is exactly what happened. No one saw this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying this is what happened. So
we do have a rumor that these studios are haunted. So
I'm going to say it is. But you know what? All of that was necessary.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad, I hope for you that you weren't bored by it or you weren't overwhelmed by it. I hope that it lets you know that it's okay to be there. And I do want you to know this. And I'm okay with sharing this with you because I think it's important that we get healing. And sometimes healing doesn't happen until much, much, much later.
Yes. And I hope that for listeners who are like, oh, no, listening to somebody's therapy session sounds like the most boring hour of my life. I understand.
Sorry.
But
sorry.
I hope that you did find them valuable or in some way informative because I do think, and I used to be this person who thought, yeah, therapy was a waste of time. But we really appreciate you as we've been going through this arc of trauma. This is a big part of it, and it has been for us personal.
Right.
Very personal.
And
so.
I think, again, just to reiterate back to why we wanted to do this, and I know we've gotten really great feedback, and thank you for those who have, and thank you for those who have stuck with us in this journey because it is unusual. And the biggest thing we wanted to relay is that it happens and it's more personal than you know. And for those who don't understand, again, why we come forward or why we don't come forward or why it's so traumatic or why it affects us on a daily basis, even if it was 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that it's important that we discuss it and it's important that we acknowledge it.
Yeah. Yep. We really appreciate all of you, all of your listeners. Yes. If you would like to email us, if you have any questions, you can. Our email is momstuff@howstuffworks. You can also find us on Twitter at momstuffpodcast and on Instagram at stuffmomnevertoldyou.
Talk to me.
Yes. Samantha's been helping me with social media. It's awesome.
Come talk to me.
Yes. And thank you, Samantha, for joining us. Thanks to Dr. Coleman for agreeing to this very unusual request.
This unusual thing.
Yes. Thanks to our super producer, Andrew,
who has
been helping us all the way through. And thanks to you for listening. Stuff Mom Never Told You is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.